given an opportunity like no other generation has been given. It's the first time people can respond at a planetary scale through the local.
In October of 2001, just weeks after 9/11, it was the B-2 bomber from Whiteman Air Force Base that first violated the airspace of Afghanistan and started raining down fire on the city of Kabul. Within a few days, more than 3,000 people, more than died in the World Trade Center on 9/11, were killed in Kabul. Probably none of these people even knew that the World Trade Center had been bombed.
John Kerry lied 35 times. He didn't know that it was Bashar al-Assad, and I heard today shows that it wasn't the government of Syria. It was the rebels trying to mousetrap the United States of America into a war against Bashar al-Assad. That's about as bad as it gets, guys, okay? So,
stand by for Tell Somebody. Somebody, April 24th, 2014, www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, @TellSomebodyNow. This is your host, Tom Clammer. If you have any comments or questions on the show, drop me a line at mail@TellSomebody.us. Physicist, ecological activist and author Dr. Vandana Shiva was a guest on Tell Somebody on April 3rd. You can find links to listen to or download that show at tellsomebody.us. Vandana Shiva spoke at Unity Temple on the Plaza this past Thursday night, April 17th. Many of you may have been there to hear her in person or were able to listen live on KKFI. And I think we may also rebroadcast her talk in the coming weeks. Dr. Shiva also appeared at a dinner at Johnson County Community College last Friday and made some pretty brief remarks there. She gave something of an homage to cow dung and made passing reference to Monsanto Corporation, headquartered on the other side of our great state of Missouri. Give a listen.
Thank you to the farmers who grew the food, the students who've helped, the chefs who've cooked, the wonderful company. And the friends who are probably playing a game, or it's weekend party time. We call food Anna. And there's a phrase that is used all the time in India, Annam Brahman. Food is the creator. And when you think of the fact that it's the food going from the soil to us and back, and that's the challenge we have to really do. We thought that chemical fertilizers would fertilize the soils. We've got to close the fertility loop between humans and the soil that feeds us. A very big challenge for cities. I'm trying to do it for the Ganga because so much sewage is going into the Ganga. And we're working on trying to declare the two sides of the Ganga as organic zones, large piece of work. But, you know, with good work, you can't ever say it's too big. Because when it comes to doing the right thing, you have to do it. That's just the imperative. I noticed one of our guests today, her name is Annapurna, which is the goddess of food. There's a lot of confusion about goddesses in India. I love them because of their multiple hands, because they symbolize diversity. Lalita Sahasranam, the one who plays and the one who has thousand names. That's the creativity of the world. And then different aspects get different names. Lakshmi becomes the goddess of wealth. And in India, the goddess of wealth includes the cow dung that becomes the compost. We have a day after Diwali where we literally worship the cow dung. It's called Gobardhan Puja. And because for me so much learning comes from the seed and the soil, every time I see cow dung, I just say thank you. And once in South Africa, it was 10 years after the Earth Summit, all of the treaties of Rio were being undone and were being turned into market instruments. And so all the environmentalists who had worked for those treaties, we got together from across the world and had a press conference to say, we're not going to be part of this. We are here to protect the Earth. We're not here to privatize the water. We are not here to commodify the atmosphere and do emissions trading. And just towards the end of the press conference, a hand came through with cow dung. And I said, oh, an organic farmer has brought me cow dung. And then the face comes behind the hand. And I recognize him as a PR person of Monsanto from India. And he says, no, it's the bullshit award for making the world starve with organic. I said, you can call it bullshit. It's still compost well. It's still cow dung. And then I had a composting ceremony outside the big conference hall. And then a Swedish filmmaker who's following me everywhere actually has made a film called Bullshit about my years of my conversations with our neighbor at the other end of the state. What I've learned in these, you know, four decades really of working for the earth and 3 decades of working for seed is that diversity is our first richness. The mindsets that we have been made popular have made diversity look like a problem, both in nature, in the farm, and so you have all the corn and soya. But that corn and soya wouldn't be growing if there wasn't whole structure to make it grow. If there weren't the subsidies, there wasn't the insurance, there wasn't everything else that makes it the only thing the farmer can do. Because wherever people choose through their freedom, they grow diversity. I remember a few years ago, it was 2008, and it was the year of the Wall Street collapse. And after the subprime crisis, a lot of the investment firms moved immediately to land and food as the places for profit. And as they invested in food, as they always say, 25% is the return to every level of investment. So if you have 3 investors, you've already shot the price 75%. And so the prices of food went up in India. Totally unconnected, except that the financial world is connected. And we are eaters of dal. Our protein comes from the dal, from the pulses, the leguminous families. And this is another side, little story. When I started to save seeds, I would go and look for the seeds of Geheth, we call it Geheth. And then I'd come back and look at the literature to find out the English name. I would get the local name. I had the scientific name. The English name was horse gran. Then the chana, we call it the chana, name is chickpea. The avre is cowpea. And I said, what on earth's going on? Why is everything an animal feed? I think it's because the British didn't know what they were. Could do with all this. They fed it to the animals and named forever very important food sources as animal feed, and that got neglected. The Green Revolution destroyed it. So dals were becoming cared, but the price of dal went up to 150 rupees a kilo. And suddenly we had this thing called I dal in the subsidized food shops. Couldn't figure out. Turns out it was soya powder ground up, shaped into a dal, colored yellow. Fake dal. And I think they said, oh, you know, Mr. Steve Jobs did so well with the I, you know, the iPad, the iPhone, and they just put I dal and everyone's going to jump on it because it's about technology. And that, I think, is the fascinating moment we are in, that every destruction is being justified in the name of technological progress when we are aware that food is about the state of our pollinators, and we have guests who look after the pollinators. It is about the state of our soils, it's the state of our communities, it's the hope for our future. It's the state of the atmosphere. 40% greenhouse gases are coming from an industrial model of farming. That's why I wrote my book, Soil Not Oil. Because agriculture was a missing piece in the discussion on climate change. And the same agriculture that contributes to climate change is then vulnerable to it. It's the kind of agriculture that absolutely fails with extended drought, a heat wave, too much cold. It just can't deal with the flexibility. Diversity is again what we need to deal with the onslaught of climate change. But not only does it help us adapt, it actually helps us mitigate. We could get rid of 40% emissions. All of the world's negotiations are about 5% reduction. And here we have systems of growing good food locally that are the biggest contribution we could make to climate havoc. But it's not just about the climate either. It is about our health. We've just started to wake up to the fact that bad food is the single biggest contributor to bad health. And good food is the biggest contributor to good health. And that's why in India, the philosophy and science of Ayurveda, and it is a science, Ayur means life, the Veda is knowledge, the knowledge of living, knowledge of life. So it's both a system of medicine, a system of eating. You talk to the grandmothers, everything they did was according to Ayurveda. And what I love is one simple principle. Because everyone's measuring how much nutrients, how much this, how much that. Ayurveda says, make sure your meal has five tastes. And when you have the five tastes, you're going to have a balanced diet. But what I'm really excited about at this point, where in a way the future is being closed for our future generations. You can do an MBA if you're privileged and maybe join a firm. Otherwise, this less and less options for the future. And I really feel the earth is inviting us to say the governments might be having austerity programs. Giant corporations might be increasing their profitability by laying 4,000 off here, 5,000 off there, which is normally the way it happens. But the earth is boundless in her giving. And we have the opportunity to make creative links between creative work and the cultivation of good food, creative work and the distribution of good food, creative work and healing through good food, creative work and education, a different kind of education, like the education that we promote at the Earth University at the Navdanya Farm, where at any point we have people from around the world, courses, full 200 farmers come at a time, learn, and go back. Teaching to learn from the earth, a different kind of learning, but a learning we need very, very deeply. we've been given an opportunity like no other generation has been given. Every other generation has been given the opportunity of changing specific things in specific line, and the women fought for the vote, and you had the movement against slavery, and we had our freedom movement. It's the first time people can respond at a planetary scale through the local. That every little urban garden we create, we are in fact taking care of the planet as a whole. We are taking care of the Earth community as a whole. We are taking care of humanity as a whole. Because with every seed we plant and every organic field we create, we are creating another path and another imagination. And I want to thank you all because you're doing it. And I want to thank you that you allowed me to be part of this process. And I invite any of you who can come to be part of our process in India. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Shiva. Thank you all for coming. The bar is open, like you said, till 8:30. We would love to, for those of you who are new to us with Cultivate, we'd love to have you come into our organization, get involved, volunteer, figure out collaborations, figure out partnerships. Our organization is all about cultivating, creating, catalyzing changes in the city. And so if you are in a part of the city that needs food, if you're in a part of the city that needs to address growing food, changing the environment, we would love to help you with that process. So we encourage you to not only come to this event tonight, but to come into relationship with us and to become part of an increasingly powerful local food movement that is changing our city. So enjoy your dessert, enjoy the rest of your meal, and thank you very much.
Dr. Vandana Shiva speaking last Friday, and then the last voice you heard there was Catherine Kelly, co-founder and director of Cultivate KC. You can find much more information at www.cultivatekc.org. On Sunday, April 6th, after hearing Robert McChesney at the All Souls Forum in Kansas City, my old pal Mike Murphy and I drove to Whiteman Air Force Base with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern for a Ground the Drones peace demonstration. Ray McGovern and Brian Terrell, co-coordinator of Creative Voices for Nonviolence, who spent 6 months in prison for trespassing at the base in 2012 during a drone protest, were the featured speakers. Terrell was a guest on Tell Somebody on April 17, 2012, just before his arrest as part of a trifecta resista weekend trio of protests against nuclear weapons production in Kansas City, Missouri, the abuse of Chelsea Manning at Fort Leavenworth, and U.S. drone policy at Whiteman Air Force Base near Knob Noster, Missouri. There will, by the way, be another trifecta resista weekend, May 30th to June 1st. In his remarks, Terrell talked about the detention of Tamara Severns. As Jane Stover of Peaceworks KC wrote on their website, Tamara Severns of Kansas City, Missouri was arrested unexpectedly during an April 6 protest of drone warfare at Whiteman Air Force Base. Tamara was walking towards the visitor center to use the bathroom. She and other resistors had used those facilities with no problem during about 5 earlier protests. On April 6, Tamara and several others had arrived at the base entry after authorities had warned the resistors not to step across the white line on the entrance road. Unaware that the rules had changed, Tamara crossed the line to go towards the visitor center, was taken into custody with no warning, and was handcuffed, searched, and detained on the base for about an hour. Tamara received a U.S. District Court violation notice for trespassing on military installation and expects to be summoned to court. Give a listen now to Brian Terrell speaking at Whiteman Air Force Base on April 6th.
They say the criminal always returns to the scene of the crime. And so I'm here with Ron and remembering Mark Kenny, who was with us that day, too. And, you know, our trial was interesting because there wasn't any contention that there was not a crime being committed here on that day and that trespassing was not occurring. But the crime that was being committed was the trespassing of drones from Whiteman Air Force Base into the airspace of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and a number of other places that was probably going on that day as well. One of the things, and I think this is to do with what just happened to our sister Tamara. In our trial, it was pretty much a settled deal that what we did was not against the law. What we did was not trespassing. The usual process is for a visitor is to go to the visitor center and you state your business and they determine whether or not you're legitimate. There's more than 3,000 civilians living on this space. There's thousands more civilians working on this space. There's all this traffic going in and out. The officers who testified against us pretty much explained that on an ordinary day, and if they didn't know we were coming to protest, if we came because we said we had some papers we wanted to deliver to the headquarters, that would have been considered legitimate. We would have been given directions about where to go. So the fact that we were protesters, the fact that we were doing what our Constitution says is protected, is why the three of us were arrested. And irony is that we finally got on the base in handcuffs. And for this I did 6 very productive months in prison, you know, for this crime. And of course, Tamara, whatever they say about it, an ordinary citizen, civilians there sitting on the grass and everything, if she was not a part of our group, yes, ma'am, the bathroom is right here, you're welcome. It's a, you know, it's a human right, damn it. I want to say something, too, that was very much a part of our trial. We're here at the Spirit Gate, and that church-looking building over there is the Spirit Chapel. Spirit. What does that refer to? Rest assured, if you're concerned about the establishment of religion clause of the First Amendment, this is not about the third person of the Holy Trinity. And the spirit referred to is not the Higgs boson particle, and it is not the animating force that you know that creates life. No, the spirit is the nickname of the B-2 bomber. And if you look at just as the MQ-9 is the Predator, you know, the Air Force assigns nicknames to its weapon systems. So this gate and that chapel, the spirit that is invoked here, the spirit worshipped here, is the B-2 bomber. And our judge, in pretty much admitting that what we did was very, very small, justified our conviction because he said he felt a very strong personal obligation to protect the B-2 bomber, even though the officers who testified against us assured the court that that there was no danger to any of the equipment here. If you look at Whiteman's official website, one of the things that they are very, very proud of is the B-2 bomber from Whiteman Air Force Base. At present, this is the only base where the B-2 stealth bomber is based. In October of 2001, just weeks after 9/11, it was the B-2 bomber from Whiteman Air Force Base that first violated the airspace of Afghanistan and started raining down fire on the city of Kabul. Within a few days, more than 3,000 people, more than died at the World Trade Center on 9/11, were killed in Kabul. Probably none of these people even knew that the World Trade Center had been bombed. Innocent people, men, women, and children, murdered in their homes by the Spirit B-2 bomber from this base. Now what the drone is doing, see the B-2 bomber getting it across the ocean and across continents, it has to be refueled in the air several times. It's a huge operation to get it there. The drone is very, very small. It's comparatively cheap. It's much easier, and the drone trespass over Afghanistan and Pakistan and these other places is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and done from the safety of this base. Also, I looked at the website again today. I hadn't seen it since I was preparing for my trial last year. And I notice, and I take some small notice of my influence over the United States Air Force because they've changed their mission statement. As I drew attention to what their mission statement was, and you can still, it's referred to on several other Air Force sites, but their mission statement at the time we were arrested here described why this base exists. Skilled and proud airmen providing full spectrum, expeditionary B-2 global strike and global support capabilities to geographic commanders and the commander, with a capital C, U.S. STRATCOM, while supporting Team Whiteman. We kick down doors and kill targets. Weapons on target, on time. That's been replaced with some very tame words about professionalism. In Thomas Merton's diaries from 1940, from before he was well known, just after his conversion, and he was writing about the war that was taking place in Europe at the time, and the United States wasn't involved. And, of course, like all Americans, nervous about what the future was going to hold. And he wrote then that we need to be against war. We need to hate war for better reasons than that war is inconvenient and dangerous. We need to be against war for better reasons than that we can, you know, lose our houses, our refrigerators, our cars, our limbs, and our lives. And that as long as what we're trying to do is avoid unpleasant sensations and enjoy the pleasant ones, that we are going to only see more misery and more suffering. And I think the drone is, you know, the epitome of what Merton saw as a nightmare. That we have a way that we can imagine, we can just imagine that we can fight a war from thousands of miles away, you know, without any danger to ourselves. And as President Obama says, that we can pinpoint surgically, we can find the people who are causing us harm, threatening us harm, and without doing any harm to the civilians among whom they are hiding. And we're finding that to be, you know, to be untrue in many, many ways. And the irony of it is that the drone, which is meant to keep war away and to keep our soldiers far away from the battlefield, actually brings the war closer. One drone operator said, "I am 7,000 miles away from the war, the distance from here to Afghanistan, and I'm at the same time 18 inches away from the war," distance from his face to the screen. And several operators have been talking, come out and talked about the intimacy that they have with their victims. One airman from Creech Air Force Base in Nevada was describing how he was asked for days, for weeks, every day he would sit down at the console, and he was with this high-definition video following these two men everywhere they went, you know, to work, to pick up their kids from school, to working in their yards, going to the mosque. And other people were watching this video feed of the CIA and other people in the military. Somebody determined then that these men were a danger, and he was ordered to kill them. And he did, with Hellfire missiles. And Brandon Bryant testified that he did not see anything on that screen that made him think that these people were any potential danger to the United States or to anyone. That determination was made somewhere else, by someone else. He did say, though, "I saw enough to know they were good daddies." I had the opportunity recently to talk to a soldier just back from Afghanistan. And he told me that he had actually killed some people there, and he felt bad about it, but he wasn't losing sleep because he was saying, "No, look, I don't know the politics. I was there with my buddies. Some people were shooting at me, and we shot back, and some of my friends died, and some of them died, and there was nothing I could do about it." Now, he is actually... this man who was on the ground was actually more distant from the battle than Brandon Bryant, who was working 8-hour shift and going home and taking a shower and sleeping in his own bed. Because all he knew was he was being shot at. He did not see the people, did not see their lives. He had no relationship with those people who he killed. So this distance that we create actually is you know, very, very dangerous. So what we have here at Whiteman Air Force Base, the religious imagery continues. We have the B-2 Spirit bomber. Now they're flying drones, and as Jane was saying a couple years ago when we started, the primary drone flown out of here was the Predator. What would George Orwell say about that? The Predator is now being superseded by the next generation, which they're calling the Reaper. And this is the imagery of the Grim Reaper, the one who God sends to you and says your time's up. And even if you're not religious, if you've ever seen a New Yorker magazine and look at the comics, the Grim Reaper is a common part of our culture. We all know what that means. The weapon with which the Reaper is armed is the Hellfire missile. And we have a situation now, we call it Terror Tuesdays, where the President of the United States is meeting with his advisors, and they are looking through, they look like baseball cards, it's how it's been described by people who've leaked out information. And they're looking at the pictures and the specifications, the stats on different high-level targets. And the president decides who is going to die. And now you have the president of the United States deciding to whom the Reaper will go and when, and to whom the Reaper will deliver hellfire. Now, friends, we have to realize that's a theological statement there. That's just as much as calling this goddamn bomber as the Spirit bomber. It's blasphemous in just the deepest sense. Well, I had the opportunity. I was 6 months in jail, and since then, I describe it, the sensation was there, like I was able to get outside every day and walk along around the yard. And I walk for hours every day. The most wonderful days was when it was South Dakota winter, when it was 40 below zero, and then there was nobody else there. On the nice days like this in April, it was like Fifth Avenue on a... but I was walking and thinking about these things, and as soon as I got out, it was my family and community helping me in Beloit and everything. I was able to do a whole lot of traveling, and it was like a tightly wound spring, finally letting go, and bing. And I've been lots of places. And I was able to be in October. I was in Great Britain, in the United Kingdom, for a week of action against drones. And it worked out serendipitously that I was able to be in Lincoln, the city of Lincoln, for the trial of four friends who were arrested for trespassing at a military base there, RAF Waddington, Royal Air Force Base Waddington. Now, the Royal Air Force of the United Kingdom has for many years had a wing based at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, and that's still there. But a couple years ago, they started flying drones out of their own base in Lincoln. And one of the defendants who was defending himself, Keith Hendon, who's a young Church of England vicar, testified that when he cut the hole and went into the fence, RAF Waddington, that he was entering into a war zone. Now, the Crown prosecutor objected that he had said that and wanted that stricken from the record. And he argued, no, there are people in uniform behind that fence who are flying planes and who are dropping bombs and firing missiles. He said, they are at war. And he said, this is the first time since World War II that war has been fought on the on British ground. Finally, after back and forth, tis it tisn't, the judge ruled RAF Waddington is well and truly a combat zone. It is a place from which war is being waged. And that kind of took the wind out of the prosecutor's sails, but they're still found guilty regardless of that ruling. And Keith also testified that when he was inside the fence, he was looking out, and this base is in... Waddington is in suburbia around Lincoln, and seeing civilian neighborhoods right up to the fence and seeing children playing in their yards and knowing that they are targeted, that it's a legitimate target. One drone operator with the National Guard in Ohio was saying that when we had F-16s, we would, on the base, we'd be training to go to war. And now with the drones, they're going to war every day. Every day they're fighting. So what's happening is, Keith testified that all these people and the children he saw playing were being cynically used by Her Majesty's government as human shields. So our efforts at keeping the war far away, the efforts at keeping our comforts, making sure the war stays over there, you know, is false, and it's going to be crashing in on us. It will have to crash in on us. The war cannot be kept far away. The war is brought home. And across this fence now, beyond these gates, you know, the war crimes are not only being committed in places far away. The airmen from Whiteman Air Force Base do not have to fly to the other side of the planet to be killing civilians. They're doing it from right here. I'm really happy. I've you know, shared a platform with Ray at the CIA headquarters in Virginia and at Langley. And I'll hand it over to you. But I just want to say that I very often, and especially this morning when I was looking at the news on the computer, how many times I hear the news these last few years, and the first thing that comes to mind is, what would Ray McGovern say about this? And I'm really happy that he's here today to give us his take on today's news. Well, thank you. Thank you, Ray.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm not often introduced by a prophet. I don't mean that Brian can foretell the future. What I mean is a prophet in the biblical sense. A person who stands up for justice. A person who does what's right no matter what the consequences. That is my idea of a prophet in the pure biblical sense. You know, a lot of people don't know much about prophets, but I've done a little study of the Hebrew scriptures as well as the Christian, and most of you probably don't know that Isaiah walked around for 2 years stark naked. Did you know that? No, you didn't know that. Yeah. It's true. It's right in there. Okay. Now, my question to you is, what's a prophet doing walking around stark naked? Now, the exegetes, you know, the fancy people that interpret the Bible, say, well, it's not clear that he was always naked, just during liturgical services. Now, that may be good exegesis, but it does not get the guy off the hook. Well, what was he saying? You know, this, I think this is what he was saying. Look, I strip myself of my garments, and you say, oh, isn't that terrible? You are stripped of the vision with which Yahweh blessed you. A vision of justice and shalom, and that is far more culpable, far more worthy of contempt than being stripped of your clothes. So when I see a person like Brian Terrell who's willing to do what's necessary to bear witness so the rest of us can all take counsel and take hope and take good example from that, then I feel particularly honored. Now, does anyone have a Bible? Yeah. Well, now, this is very telling. This is very telling indeed.
Now,
this is
Chuck Hadlin, but he got in a car accident. We're here to have his.
Yeah, he only had one Bible here in town. This is Bible country, is it not? You know, I mean, is this real heavy Christian country here? And we couldn't find a Bible. Well, you know, I'm going to have to rely on memory then, you know.
Can you say who you are, too, right?
Oh,
introduce yourself.
Who I am. Yeah,
yeah,
I'm supposed to say who I am.
Yeah, please.
Let's see, who am I? Okay, I'm Ray McGovern from New York City originally. Came down as a second lieutenant in the Army, finished Army Intelligence and Infantry Schools, and after my 2-year service, joined the Central Intelligence Agency where I worked for 27 years on analysis, not on operations. Now, what I want to kind of search my memory for are some stuff that I remember from the Bible, okay? Now you may think that, the Bible is sort of
Alberto Gonzalez, the adjective he used to describe the Geneva Conventions, you know, that they're quaint and obsolete.
I don't think the Bible is obsolete, so those of you who do will just have to bear with me. There is something in the Bible that says, thou shalt not kill. And I don't think that's been amended or revoked, even by the Bush administration, you know. His dad said that he read through the Bible all the way through twice. Now, I don't think he remembered an awful lot, but apparently that is still in the Bible. Now, what am I saying that for? I'm saying that because those who don't place much store by the Bible, and there are lots of folks here, I imagine. You know, I like Kurt Vonnegut. You know, he was a big humanist, you know. He was an atheist, agnostic, or whatever. And somebody says, well, Kurt, what do you think of Jesus of Nazareth? And he said, well, you know, I'm not sure he was God, but if it weren't for the Sermon on the Mount, I think I'd just as soon be a cockroach. Now, what do we remember about the Sermon on the Mount? Well, remember a couple of things. Blessed are the peacemakers, because they shall be called children of God. Then there's one toward the end. It says, blessed are those who sacrifice for justice, who thirst for justice, for they shall be satisfied. And then right at the end, the kicker. Blessed are you when people make fun of you, when people call you every name in a book, because that's exactly what happened to the prophets of the Old Testament. Rejoice. This is your chance to testify. This is your chance to be a prophet like Brian. So, that's good news. Kurt Vonnegut, I think, has it right. Okay. I want to just put a little bit more perspective on this, because I do speak out of a Judeo-Christian perspective. But I was talking about torture one time, and I was saying, you know, I feel particularly against torture because the fellow I try to follow, his name is Jesus of Nazareth, he was tortured to death, and it sort of, you know, adds a certain tone to torture for me. And the fellow I was staying with was an atheist, and he said later by email, he says, Ray, it's really nice that you talk about your Judeo-Christian background and all that, but you know what? I'm an atheist, but I know that human beings don't do that to other human beings, all right? So get off this kick about, you know, you have to be a believer. Human beings don't do that. Don't torture other human beings. And human beings don't drop bombs on other human beings either, or shoot missiles at them, even if they can't see them, even if they're sitting behind some console or flying off in some supersonic aircraft like the B-2 that flies out of here. So, that having been said, let me get back here to the fact that this is Christian territory. I'll bet that those sheriffs over there, I'll bet that many of these soldiers and airmen here went to church this morning. I'll bet they did, because isn't it Sunday? It is Sunday, yeah. And, you know, when I look at the sign at this place, and then I think of, you know, the old WWJD. Anybody know what that is? What would Jesus do? Well, I don't know if he'd climb into that bomber there. And I'm sure that, you know, even though we picture Jesus as a white man, I don't think he was any more a white man than White Man Air Force Base. And I just think this points to something very profound and something very ugly. White Man Air Force Base is a reflection of the American original sin, which is racism. Whether it's the Native Americans, whether it's the African Americans, the Latinos, whatever it is, our original sin is racism. And when the B-2s flew off here into Afghanistan and into Iraq, they weren't killing folks like us. No, no, no. They were killing people that our soldiers and airmen were taught to call ragheads, or worse still, sand niggers. They had things on their head that didn't look like the hats that we wear. And, you know, this definition that they give to these kinds of people beyond the pale, those people that they are labeling that are precisely the ones that Jesus called the least of these. And what are we supposed to do to the least of these? I don't think it's to bomb them or to send hellfire missiles to them. I think hellfire has to do with what God wants to do if one believes in hell, you know? This is really pretty profound. White men killing brown, black, other men and women and children that don't look like us. Couldn't be more clear. You know, God luckily has a sense of humor, but sometimes the irony just sticks out in a way you can't avoid it. Stealth bombers. Brian already pointed out that they were the first ones to go bombing Afghanistan. Why? Well, because we could, and because we could refuel several times. They could fly right over here and refuel 1,800 times and come back, well, but just about three times and come back here, and who, within the local folks would what? Clap. Man, this is great. The bombers are coming right from right here in Missouri, from our own right, yeah? So that's the kind of mindset that we have been subjected to. Now, stealth bombers are still doing their job, and they're still
prepared to do more. We heard about shock and awe before Iraq, right? Okay. Well, there was some shock and awe prepared involving these stealth aircraft before the inches away from war in Syria in the very beginning of September of last year. John Kerry talked about, quote, an unbelievably short war, end quote. Well, now, John Kerry, you know, he might have been good about steering a boat up the Mekong, but he clearly isn't a strategic thinker if he thinks there can be an unbelievably small war in the Middle East. We know now, because of the article that published this morning from Cy Hirsch, that it was shock and awe all over again. It wasn't an unbelievably small war. It was stealth bombers. It was the whole nine yards. We were going to obliterate those people. And it's easy to do because, you know what? They don't look like us. They look like towel heads. And besides, it's really easy to do that because you can't even see. You're in a stealth bomber. Man, you just drop the things. You tell the instrument what to do. And you don't, you know, you go home and have dinner with your wife. Now, John Kerry talked on the 30th of August about Bashar al-Assad did these chemical attacks, and that's why we have to use all these aircraft and everything else to go after him, right? Guess what? John Kerry lied 35 times. He didn't know that it was Bashar al-Assad, and Cy Hirsch today shows that it wasn't the government of Syria. It was the rebels trying to mousetrap the United States of America into a war against Bashar al-Assad. That's about as bad as it gets, guys, okay? So, these weapons of non-mass destruction, weapons of destruction, however you describe them, can be used for ostensibly unbelievably small wars, but wars that are really full-scale attacks, shock and awe, having nothing to do with the spirit that we celebrate on Sunday, but rather with a spirit of violence, a spirit of racism. Now, I want to talk a little bit about drones, because there you have this, a syndrome that has not really existed in the armed forces before. You have people standing or sitting behind consoles pushing little buttons and killing people. Now, I think even some of those pilots are having real conscience problems, and chaplains on bases like this are having long waiting lines to have consultation with these young men and women. But you can't really hide behind a console. And you can't really pretend when you pilot a stealth bomber that nobody is getting killed. You can't do that. One of the things that my Catholic worker friends in Los Angeles put on their little bumper sticker about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks was this: nothing that is hidden will remain hidden. Luke. I forget the verse. I'm a Catholic. I don't remember the verses. Something like Luke 4:17 or something like that. Okay. Nothing that is hidden will avoid being revealed. Now, the problem is, who's going to reveal it? Right? Is our president going to reveal it? Our president gets up on the 17th of May last year and says, you know, I feel really bad about it. Yeah, I really feel so bad about these drone strikes. I wish I could stop them, but... they won't let me stop. Give me a break. The president would stop those things with a snap of his finger if he had some backbone, okay? So, what are we talking about here? Who's going to stop this carnage? Oh, I know. The church. Yeah, the church. You know, if you look for moral leaders, you'll look to the churches, the institutional churches. And, of course, they have all spoken out very strongly against killing people by remote control in these consoles, haven't they? Uh-oh. Have they not?
Unitarians have.
You know what, folks? Very few have. And it reminds me very much of what happened. It reminds me very much, and that's a suitable sound effect, of what happened in Nazi Germany in the 30s
when the Lutheran and the Catholic churches could not find their voice, and when Hitler, first thing he did when he took power, do you know what he did? He made sure that there was a parish priest in every Lutheran and Catholic parish. Do you know why? Because he thought that would be a factor of stability for his regime, and it was. So, now that's not really good news, is it? What's the good news? The good news is there's us, okay? Cesar Chavez, people used to always say, oh, there aren't enough of us, there aren't enough of us. Well, there are enough of us, okay? But if we let speaking and writing and that kind of thing suffice, without action, nothing's going to happen. That's why it's so good to be here. That's why it's so good to be a personal representative of justice and of what Jesus really taught, for those of who are believers, and what the Hebrew Scriptures also taught. So let me kind of finish up talking about the institutional church, because if the church does not speak out against this wanton slaughter of black and brown people simply because we can do it, then the church is the same kind of religious institution that Jesus of Nazareth spoke out against and got killed for speaking out against it. Dr. King, Martin Luther King, talked about exposing evil. And in his masterful letter from the Birmingham City Jail, he said this, like a boil that can never be cured, but must be opened with all its pus-flowing ugliness to the natural medicines of air and light, so too injustice and deceit and killing must be exposed with all the friction its exposure creates to the light of human conscience and the air of national opinion before it can be cured. That's why we're here. That's why we're hoping that everyone from the airmen to the sheriffs and others can hear the real word. Now, Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker, of which Brian, of course, is a member, her granddaughter is in Hawaii right now, and she wrote me an email saying that she can hear the B-52s going on bombing runs over the Pacific as she was writing this email. Okay. She also reminded me recently that when her grandmother, Dorothy Day, talked about the filthy, rotten system that was at the core of all our problems, it wasn't capitalism. It wasn't the abuses of our government. It was the institutional church. That's big, folks. We can't wait for the institutional church to find its voice. The Germans waited for it. It never found its voice, and so the Germans just went, well, if the priest won't tell us it's wrong, it must be all right. So it's really up to us. It really is up to us. And as Cesar Chavez said, there are enough of us. So just to wind up here, we talk of the victims of these drone strikes and of the B-2s. We're talking about the least of these. And, you know, there's only one criterion that's mentioned in the Christian Bible of how we are to be judged. And that's in Matthew 25. And it says, as much as you did this to the least of these, you did them to me. Now, that's not obsolete. That's not quaint. Jesus identified himself with us, with the towel heads, with the people who don't look like us, even more so than with us who have it relatively easy. So, at the final judgment, airmen, listen, this is really important. The final judgment, you're not going to ask how professional you were at your consoles. You're not going to be asked how proficient you were in sticking that little X over your target. You're going to be asked how you treated the least of these. Keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ray.
that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody or anytime you like at www.tellsomebody.us.